I was just on a board call this week, and one of the challenges that industry is having right now is that there's so many certificates out here, right? That they don't know how to evaluate. They don't know how to evaluate which certificate is better than the other, or what is it teaching, or what are they learning, and things like that. So I do think there's going to probably be a need in career counseling and career education to start to be able to show the value of how these, once again, going back to value, how these certificates, which were really quick and fast, was the differentiating factor with that. So showing that value in workforce. And yeah, I think that, so there's that. But as I mentioned, is that because we've got this enrollment cliff coming, we have to be more innovative in how a university approaches the student now. It has to be inclusive. It has to be inclusive because we're going to miss the mark.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the mind shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. We're thrilled to have Dr. Aaron D. Tucker Oluwole, a true titan in the hospitality and tourism industry, with us today. As the chair of the Hospitality and Tourism Management Department at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, she spearheads a vibrant program across three campuses. Erin is also the co-founder of DMV Black Restaurant Week, which is a testament to her commitment to diversity and inclusion in the industry. Her 25-year career has been Her 25-year career has seen her consulting for both small businesses and major corporations, and her expertise has been sought after for high-profile events like the 2016 Democratic National Convention. As a recognized leader, she's been quoted in esteemed publications like the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And in 2022, she was named one of the 25 most influential educators in hospitality. Beyond her work in academia, she's deeply involved in workforce development, supporting African American and Black entrepreneurs, and advocating for innovative initiatives in agritourism. So let's welcome Dr. Aaron Tucker Oluwole to the Innovation Insights podcast. Erin, it's great to have you here.
So great to be here. Thank you so much, Dr. Sanders. This is exciting.
I think we met about 6 or 7 years ago. It was at an iGREE conference.
Right.
I thought, I need to get to know this person better.
But I viewed you as definitely someone who it was like, oh my gosh, you're in a space I definitely desired to really look at and be in and what I could do more within my career. For me, it was looking at you like, oh my gosh, I want to be like her. And your style, everything. And I think even just the ability to be able to, you have to keep going and smile and laugh, and you have to continuously do those things because we're in such an industry where, and a discipline where, you know, we take ourselves so seriously, and we really have to give ourselves that grace.
We do have to give ourselves grace. And I will say, being an educator that ended up in a leadership position that had a hospitality management and an event management program, I was so welcomed by the faculty internationally within the disciplines, and you were one of them. So thank you for having open arms and welcoming me and mentoring me too, because I needed a lot of mentoring. I still do. So thank you.
Absolutely.
So your career has been remarkable, and I follow you also on social media, and you are one of the most connected people out there. You are, and you're doing some really fantastic work. So would you share your background and what brought you into the hospitality area and inspired you to be in it?
It was great you used the word connected, because I think at the end of the day, we all are. We spend a lot of time seeking out people, and it's right there within our journey. So I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois, Southsider, went to Florida A&M University. And when I was in my senior year, I really wanted to follow my passion, which in taking a course, there was this, we were talking about sport management. It was a management course. And I thought that was really interesting. So I said, I made a commitment to myself that I wanted to always, if I'm going to spend my rest of my life working, I wanted to do work where I'm excited about and work that I'm interested in. It wasn't that deep of what exactly that looked like, but I knew that's what I wanted. And so I ended up, to the chagrin of my parents, I didn't tell them that I ended up turning down the corporate job offers and went back to Chicago, and I interned for a sports agent because I was really interested in sport management. And I remember I was like doing some other stuff like volunteering and all that. And after a year, I decided I wanted to go get my master's degree in sport management. So I went back to Florida, and I went to Florida State. And I did two internships there. I did one with the RDV Sports, which now was the PGA, which is now the RD, which is known as Orlando Magic. Like most people know that. And then I also did one with the PGA Tour. And it was really the tour that I love to tell students that was like the real job, the one that had the benefits and the salary. And I negotiated sponsorship agreements between Cadillac and Buick and the PGA Tour and the Senior Tour. And it was a phenomenal experience. I did it for 4 years. And then my life shifted and I ended up going from Atlanta, Georgia, where I was working, to Charlotte. And I couldn't do necessarily the same thing, but within my network, as you mentioned about connected, right? Within my network, because you get more of a network by the stuff you sometimes do outside of your job than anything else. A woman named Vanessa Gates was the head of HR for a company called Jillian's Entertainment. Now, most people don't know Jillian's, but many people know Dave & Buster's. And she said, we have this sales manager's job that I think you'd do really well. I'd engage with people, events. And I'm like, but I don't know anything about restaurants. I never worked in it. She says, don't worry about it. And so I came in. It was the other skills, right? And so I came in and I loved it. I started to do that, and to the chagrin of most people, most of my clients were corporate clients. The only difference was that I had a few more of the social events that I was selling, having to do birthday parties and things like that. And so I said, this is a great industry, but I knew I didn't want to do it forever. So I actually worked on my MBA at Winthrop University. I was in the executive MBA program, so I still worked while I was working through my MBA. And then when ended up booking a client, so a client came in named Johnson & Wales University, and everybody in Charlotte was talking about Johnson & Wales, and I was building this campus. So they were doing a high school recruiting event, and they selected our location, and my client, just like we're having a conversation here, sales, the biggest part of sales is really connecting with the person. I think everybody should do a sales job, because it's not really the selling element, is really the connection with people. And he mentioned to me, he says, we have this major called Sports Event Entertainment Management. You make a great guest speaker. And I went and guest spoke and said, this is what I want to do. After we had that period, there was a great break that I was able to do, and went over to Johnson & Wales. And I was there in a couple capacities for about 3 years. And decided at that point I wanted to work on my PhD. So that's when I went to Oklahoma State and got my PhD. And during that time frame, I had the ability to work in Singapore for 2 years. A University of Nevada, Las Vegas had a Singapore campus at a certain time. And I went and I did two stints over there. So I saw the global element of hospitality. And I came back and I finished my doctorate. And then I was at Boston University for 4 years, Temple for 2, Georgetown University for 6. And now I am at UMBS. And really, I think what brought me to UMBS was the opportunity to really be able to not just oversee hospitality and tourism, but also they have a PGA of America golf program that's part of it, which fit right in under hospitality. So it was a full circle. It was once again that connected level where I was able to pull on my sport management experience, actually working in it. And so I know what the careers are. I know it's just not one career. And then also that ability to come into a program that's been around for a long time and take it and really bring in new elements. And so that's really what got me to where I am. It sounds good. There's some things here and there. But that's
the,
yeah.
Well, the journey is never always just a straight path at all. But
it's
what?
Not.
No. But what a fascinating and such industry experience that you bring into academia, which is sometimes not there. And one thing that you mentioned, sales, and it's really being the relationships of people. And now as your role as the chair of a department, of course, you're using those skills a lot. But I was also thinking about, and this, it, each one of my guests, I think, probably like, Yolanda, you send us questions ahead of time, and then you get these thoughts while we're talking. So this is one of those.
That's right. This is a conversation.
I apologize, but this might seem like off the wall. But development and fundraising is something that is a big part of being an academic administrator, especially on the academic side at a university and working with the foundation and the development team. And so how has your background in sales and your approach to sales, because you seem like you're very people-oriented in your approach, so how's that helped with your role as an academic leader now?
Sure. Well, definitely. Absolutely. Well, definitely as a department chair, in addition to the budget management that I never really had to do before, but because I come from industry, I understood it. I have to oversee two program endowments, and those endowments are based in individual, regardless of a corporate give, even if there's a corporate name on it, there was an individual that really pushed that. In both of these programs, I have to engage with donors and speaking with them and really assuring them the vision of where the program's going, what we're doing, who we have on board. It's huge. It's a very huge element that I think a lot of, we're not taught that when we're getting our PhDs. But I think that it's really important to really be able to have that connection and to continue to build on that with that. So absolutely, sales is a part of it. You're selling the program every day to whether it's interested students to faculty. I sell the programs to get the best faculty. You have to do that. And it's, once again, it's that engaging with people and people understanding and trusting, right? In your vision. And are you going to get it there? And I think that is probably the biggest element that I've learned in leadership, is that leadership at the end of the day it sounds like a cliche, and people have probably said this on your platform before. It's really not as much about me as it is about what can I do in this position to be able to help others get what they need. And my role is to find that resource. Sometimes it's money, sometimes it's time, sometimes it's a phone call. And that is probably, it's the biggest element of learning. And I think that even with having a vision, I can still stick to my vision. But if I'm not helping others get to what they need, then you're not going to be able to execute on what it is that you want your vision to be.
I so agree with that. And I feel academia is about just helping people, period. Your students. Yeah. And then when you're in a leadership position, it's even more. But if you're a faculty member or a graduate student, and then also the communities within, or, you know, the communities that the university or the program is within, there is also that responsibility to help support them. And we'll talk a lot more about that, because you have done a fantastic job at supporting multiple communities within your career. But next, I do want to talk about some of the challenges in the hospitality industry. And no one wants to talk about 2020. We still are coming out of that. And that has had a true impact. And so what are your thoughts about what are the challenges? And then how do you see the hospitality industry evolving?
I think that the challenges that hospitality has, even if hopefully if someone looks at this in 20 years, we're not having it. But I'll tell you, the challenges in 2020 were the challenges we were having already. What 2020 did was 2020 pulled the lid off of the challenges we were facing. We were facing a living wage for our employees and what we were doing about that. We were faced with a lack of innovation, a lack of having platforms that enabled people in technology to do their jobs more efficiently and effectively. We were still in the background when it came to technology and embracing that element. So the challenges were always there. I think that what 2020 forced us to do was to make that decision of whether as owners, as managers, and as people at work, where do we stand? And some people, some owners have taken a very strong position of bringing in everything from benefits packages to flexibility in a work schedule, while some have looked at the teams and how can teams work better within the organization. And while many in our industry are still going back to still thinking of the old way and how, oh, as time goes, we're going to go backwards. I think the only difference now is we're not going to ever go back. It's never going to go back. So I think it's really forced a lot of stakeholders to have to really take a stand of what was really important to them. I remember having a conversation with an owner of a hotel, and the owner was basically asked me, she thinks that robots are going to be taking over housekeeping. And how can we stop that? And I said, you have to kind of think about it a little differently. Is it really about robots? Because technically, so many things have been automated now. It's not even about robots. It's just software can have taken the task away from many jobs. I said, but most importantly, I said, think about it like this, and you don't have to think about this as an owner. But if I'm somebody that cleans, that's my job on this planet is to clean homes or clean buildings. I have 4 platforms right now that I can put my services on, that I can work as much as I want to, get paid as much as I want to, get paid on the same day I actually do the service. That why do I need to come and work in an organization that I have to wait 2 weeks for a check and somebody telling me when I have to work? So you have to think about it as, why should that person work for you? So do we have platforms in place for our housekeeping to get paid the same day? Do we have that? I said, then that's going to be able to do those things. So that's where I think we're really are pushing and forcing ourselves as an industry to really look at and take seriously.
Makes sense. And again, putting the people first.
I've done so many, even during pandemic, so many discussions, and it was like, nobody wants to go to work. Everybody wants to. I said, no, people. Like, don't get askew. Like, they're just working differently. Once again, what are we going to do? People still clean houses. People still clean rooms. People still greet people. People are still seeing people face to face. Really? Really? So that's, I don't know if that was the answer she
I love that you mentioned technology within the two, because we hear it always, just my whole life, technology is going to take over people's jobs. It hasn't yet, but it supports it. I love the way that you have discussed that. The robots aren't going to take over. AI is not going to take over.
Yeah, it's just what we do and the lenses that we bring. So as academia, right? Those are the skills. What questions to ask, right? AI, of course, is embedded. I spent more time on AI this last semester and its usage that I thought I did not necessarily have to think of. But the reality is I had to really talk to the faculty about how we asking the questions. So we can ask questions, they can put it in, and they spit out an answer, but have them apply. Are they applying it? Give me an example of how this applies to you to a golf course that you're in. Give me an example of how this applies to a hotel that you've worked or a restaurant or whatever, a job that you've worked in, and provide that specific example. That's something that has to show more synergy, more connection than anything else. So it's how we're asking the questions and how we're pushing it and those elements. And what about this answer is, if you're going to use it, right? What about this answer? What is this answer not including? What is it not taking into consideration? And especially in the world of bias and profiling and racial stereotypes, we've seen the AI is just delivering out exactly what we put in. So it's our job to retrain it by asking the questions and looking at it and what's important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always believe too that we have to be critical and conscious consumers of any information that we get from any place, whether it's a journal, the news, the popular press, AI, looking at that. And we have to teach our students to also critique and not just say, oh, okay, they told me this.
Right. Really, my answer should have just been critical thinking, right? Back to the day.
Answer is really great and things to think about. And I loved all the questions that, you have put forward and discussing with your faculty, because that's going to help them and the students really think about how the future is going to continue to evolve within the next 5 minutes too, because there's updates to everything. So we talked about workforce, and you have been really a strong advocate of workforce development in the hospitality industry. It is such a large employer of people. And so what are some skills that the workforce needs, and how can educational institutions help prepare students?
Yeah. So, you know, workforce development as a concept has, you know, really been around a long time. I think that a lot of our community colleges were really charged with workforce development. They've been in the landscape of it, but our traditional four-year universities have not. It was not originally our space. And so what's happening now is that it is our space now. We are at a point where we are facing an enrollment cliff. And the next few years, there's a generation that has challenged us to show what the value is of the of our education, not necessarily starting. And our universities will probably, in my opinion, have a little bit of more older students, but the ones that want to go back and actually complete their degrees, how they're doing that, whether it's the use of online programs with that. So we, because of all of this, we have now been charged, and especially at where I am right now, is what are state universities doing to upskill the workforce? That was not a question that we had to ever, I never had to look at that up until quite recently. And so because we're charged with that, now it's, you have to put together not just programs, but platforms that will appeal to the workforce. But my area, it's definitely the certificate space, certificates, micro-credentials. And where we are now with that, as both a discussion, but as a point, I'll tell you, UMES, we're going to be looking at it in two spaces. One we'll talk about a little later, which is agritourism. And the other one, I'm actually going to start embracing the beverage space because people are just interested. As you mentioned, we're on three campuses, and our Shady Grove campus, which is closer to Washington, D.C., people are just, beverage is. It's its own vertical now. It's not even the food part. It's beverage. How can we take, you get certificates in that space? But it's about generating this as new revenue, a new platform for it, and just go and do it. Workforce, that's how we're really approaching that. So the skills will be a part interest, and it'll also be part a need that's desired within that area. I was just on a board call this week, and one of the challenges that industry is having right now is that there's so many certificates out here, right? That they don't know how to evaluate. They don't know how to evaluate which certificate is better than the other, or what is it teaching, or what are they learning, and things like that. So I do think there's going to probably be a need in career counseling and career education to start to be able to show the value of how these, once again, going back to value, how these certificates, which were really quick and fast, was the differentiating factor with that. So showing that value in workforce. And yeah, I think that, so there's that. But as I mentioned, is that because we've got this enrollment cliff coming, we have to be more innovative in how a university approaches the student now. It has to be inclusive. It has to be inclusive because we're going to miss the mark.
Thank you for saying that, because having had many discussions about the enrollment cliff over the years. And one of my beliefs was, yes, it will happen, but are we including the right people or opening up and making an available education available to a larger range of people? Because that can help combat this enrollment cliff. The enrollment cliff is looking at a certain demographic of individuals that have typically had access to education. But there's still a large population of people out there that haven't had access. And with that, I'm going to get off of my soapbox and move on over to the Black Restaurant Week. Tell us about that and what DMV means and just what you're doing with that, because it's been so fun to follow that. And you work with that organization on social media.
Yeah. So for many people who might question whether what does getting your driver's license have to do with Black Restaurant Week? So DMV actually stands for DC, Maryland, Virginia, Black Restaurant Week. So one, that's always, but I always assume people think that they already know. DMV Black Restaurant Week really came as when I moved to DC in 2017, I was really interested in wanting to learn more about the, not just the restaurant kind of community, but how we can put food and beverage into the curriculum. At the time, it was really lacking, and there were students that were really interested in it. I met Farrar Tate, who was a member of my church. He actually oversaw the food service, and realized after talking, he also owned a restaurant in D.C. for 18 years. So we talked a lot about it. So you actually showed me a lot about the ecosystem that was in that of the restaurant culture in D.C. And then I met Andra A.J. Johnson after reading an article about her, and she was writing, sort of putting together these ideas of African Americans in these spaces of hospitality and what their experiences were. And I said, I would love to meet her. Her expertise is really in the area of beverage in all forms. And so she, what we found is that we all had a love for education, and we had this willingness that we wanted to come together and do workforce development, because Tate was already doing some certificates in the space. But we wanted to see more African-Americans in management, ownership, things such as that. So we came together and did workforce development. That is what brought us together, was education. And then what happened was that in spring of 2018, there was an incident that happened at a Starbucks in Philadelphia where the police were called on two African-American gentlemen. And why that particular case affected me, because I lived down the street from that Starbucks. I knew exactly where it was. I was at Temple for 2 years, as I mentioned. So I knew exactly, and I never understood like what amplified. Like, that's one of those, just one of those places where like you go in and everybody's doing their own thing. So what gave cause and rise to this happening? And so that time period, there was a lot of memes also. So it was that happened. And then on top of that, it was like a lot of memes going on around Barbecue Betty, Coupon Charlie, just these incidences where how African Americans were treated within one public spaces, but also a lot of times how they were treated in restaurants and hotels. And so I think I read an article and it was like, where are the Black chefs and where are the Black owners? And I'm sitting here in DC. What do you mean, where are they? They're everywhere. And I realized, but there wasn't a platform to be able to showcase them. So I started looking around and I saw that there were these other Black restaurant weeks in the country, and there wasn't one in DC. And I said to Tate and AJ, I said, you want to do one? And she said, yeah, let's go ahead and do it. We realized before, while we were putting it together, that we did not want to follow the same model that the other Black restaurant weeks were doing. They had these very similar models that were traditional to restaurant weeks, which was a prefixed menu at $1 amount. If you look at, one, the history of African Americans in the restaurant ownership space, our history comes from catering. So many of our historically our caterers and our entrepreneurship really came from the catering space. So we said, let's include caterers. Then we're like, it's 2018. As long as you serve food, why should you not be a part of it? So most restaurants, period, but even within our community, are more fast casual. So we're like, look, if you've got a coffee bar, a shop, a Black-owned coffee shop, and you serve, let's include them. Let's include food trucks. Let's include wine bars. Let's include. So it was just, so we included that, and we just had another basis of it. And so we were very clear when we launched that we had a mission, and our mission was to help support and sustain Black-owned businesses within the hospitality and food space, restaurant space, through professional development, while also creating an ecosystem for them to thrive. Because it's not a week that's going to help businesses. It's that ability to be able to have a group and an ecosystem. And so because education brought us together, our motto was culture, education, good food. And so we use that in all of our programming. And so that is what kind of lends us to where we are. This was a couple learning tips for those who want to advocate. This was 2018. Nobody was talking about Black-owned businesses to the space. It was not that easy to sell. We had to have our data and research as to why it was important. We started with partnerships first before restaurants. And then when 2020, so it was a slower start. So I think we had 35 partners the first year. 2019, we had 42 partners. And then 2020, which was pandemic, we had 90. So it was a very opposite conversation. I understand what was going on in the world, and restaurants were going, I'm sitting here like, mixed experience in restaurants wanted to be identified as Black owned. That did not necessarily happen. We had all of a sudden all the governments that we were talking with and why it was important to have these platforms started calling us. And so it was a very different a platform, but that's the reason why we do what we do. People ask, why don't you do this type of program? Why don't you do that? Our role is to serve as a conduit between business owners and government resources to be able to thrive, not just a week.
I love it. I love it. And talk about innovation. That's such a perfect example. And so how many organizations or restaurants or food facilities are involved now?
Within the whole kind of ecosystem, it's probably about, we have 100 and I think 8 or something right now. Mm-hmm. And that's a combination, right, of our caterers and food trucks and all of that. And we found that element that ecosystem that we were trying to build. I remember one year we worked with a university with a class when it was this ecosystem. And we're like, we're building it. We just don't know what it's going to look like. What does that look like? Because they're thinking about ecosystem just from what we teach within school. But there was something, there's another type of ecosystem was about bringing community together. So this year in 2024, we were selected by DoorDash that 20 businesses could actually go through an accelerator program on growth and scale. So that was it. You have to stick to mission. It's in what it is that you do. And I'm fine with that. Like, I'm fine with, I want to perfect the model and then have a succession plan of giving it to someone else. I think I read something like Starbucks. It took Starbucks 10 years to figure out what model that they want to do. And as soon as they were done with that 10 years, they scaled. So I'm giving myself that. Stay tuned.
I will. I encourage our audience to stay tuned too. And I love what you say about scaling and then succession planning and moving on, because sometimes the thought is, as a leader or an innovator, you need to stay there through the until the end of whatever it is that you've been involved. But no, you need to move on, get out of the way, and then people move it forward. But another area that we've talked about innovation is agritourism, which I love the idea, the concept. Agriculture is just a big part of this country and the world, and it does really relate to being able to eat. Tell us your thoughts about agritourism and why is it an important part of hospitality?
Yeah, I tell you, if I was asked this a year ago, I probably would not have put agritourism in. I think definitely coming to University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which is in Princess Anne, Maryland, which is the center of the other part of Maryland, which we call Eastern Shore, that, you know, the opportunities that were starting to be presented to us. One is that the school has always had an agricultural extension. So there's an extension element of ag, and they came to us and said, hey, they actually, the year I started, they actually had their first agritourism conference. And so they were like, we really want more support from tourism. I was like, absolutely. We started talking about just the fact that there's so many farmers that are really interested in wanting to have more. The way that we are situated, once again, within Maryland is that in a 200-mile radius, a lot of people drive. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that people don't fly or taken away from trains or anything else, but not even really trains or buses. It's really people drive in this area. If people are willing to stop before they get to Ocean City, they want to go and buy from small businesses. They want to buy from farms. They want to buy more sustainable. They want to buy organic. And these farmers are already doing it, but they want to have, how do I market it? And I have a space that I want to make a bed and breakfast. How do I bring people there? And we're working with them with agritourism, besides the fact we actually have a College of Agriculture, but to combine these elements. And so it's so great going to talk to farmers and putting on boots and things like that, a whole different side that I never even really, you know, was exposed to. And to hear their willingness and their eager. And once again, we talk about workforce development. This is an area of workforce development that is not you wouldn't necessarily think about it from hospitality, but it's completely our area. So to come to bring those two together and to maybe have a certificate or module for something like that, is where we're moving towards. And this is, you don't have to, this is an area where you just, it is limitless. And I think it's a space anybody can really look at. If we were in maybe a certain part of Virginia, we might look at the wineries. That's part of agritourism. And when you talk about sustainability and environment and even wellness in some aspects, it all falls in under this very large category that the world is looking at. How can we better our systems, right? This is a much bigger conversation on our food systems. But if there's a tiny slither of this where tourism can help build the provide sustain a conduit, right? And support and services to these business owners that are farmers, then why not us? It's right there in our community. We don't have to go anywhere. And we can leave the urban areas to do what they have to do in that avenue. But it's such an area of opportunity. And we can't say that we're in support of sustainability and ignore small towns. We just can't do that. We just, as just a group of human beings, we just cannot do that. And I think that's a global discussion more than just one area.
Oh my gosh. I just love what you said and your thoughts about that. I'm a big fan of agritourism. My father, Leon Sanders, right now, who's no longer with us, is smiling at this conversation. First, two Black women talking about agriculture. Because he worked for the United States Department of Agriculture for 46 years. And so my world lens has also always been from an agricultural lens too. And so I've always thought that agritourism and hospitality and agriculture and hospitality, agriculture and textiles, they just all relate. And Leon Sanders right now is somewhere just clapping his hands, laughing. Those that know him, his giggle, just thinking, okay, this is wonderful. I think this is such a smart, and I love the idea of the certificate that you're thinking about and that collaboration with the College of Ag. So would you talk just a tad more about the certificate idea with them?
Yeah, so we're looking at it from an in-person modules perspective. So the conference that Extension had December of 23, it sold out. It was in Cambridge, Maryland. And it started a more of a deeper discussion. So we're looking at like something like four modules in person, covering a larger scope, like what is it, like just really giving the knowledge. I think it's the first element is closing a knowledge gap. And so what is it? The second would be how to market, take your farm and be able to market it. The third would be an element of kind of the financial kind of analysis and making sure that we have phenomenal financial faculty that are in these spaces as well to be able to do that. And then fourth, we're leaving them either community, something community-based, or how to engage maybe from a human resource perspective, because many farmers struggle with attracting people to work on the farms. But what's interesting is that the flip side is a lot of students or younger people are actually interested in, especially those in the sustainability space, have so many ideas. We will probably add that in as a fourth, and then Extension can take it from there with continuously following up and seeing how things are. But I think it's an excellent way for the different departments to work together within the university. And then also, of course, having the community element. So that's one thing. I'm like, no more than four modules for something like that. We might do it in a day or two or something like that. And going from there.
Fabulous. Again, so smart and great forethought. So I can't wait to see what happens and how this evolves too.
Thank you.
And it's very entrepreneurial. You've talked about working with farmers, which I believe are entrepreneurs, but then also you have been such a supporter of African-American and Black entrepreneurs through some of the previous initiatives that we've discussed. But what advice do you have for entrepreneurs in the hospitality industry?
Yeah. I think my advice is, this is twofold. One, definitely know is your idea, right? Whatever your idea is, to study your idea from a variety of different perspectives. So if you bake cakes, right, you need to learn everything, I think, from the science element of it to understanding how it can be delivered and packaged and sold and sent, and know everything there is the technology about your product. But the other side is you have to be a good business person. And so we don't balance those two, right? We talk about how you should form your company, but why you should form it that way. As a reluctant entrepreneur myself, and I say that I'm never really wanted to really be an entrepreneur. I just saw a gap. And I figured, okay, I want to separate my expenses from my personal and then my liability. And someone said, hey, you need to come up with it. You need to have an LLC. But the ability to how you even select your company, everyone stops with the LLC and say, oh, you don't need to be an S Corp or a C Corp. But the S Corp has a whole different element of tax benefits that I never really thought about, down to the house that you own. It's an not just deductibles, but how you can actually use it. In an S Corp, you can do it. In a single entity LLC, you can't do it. I'm saying it in a sense of going deeper into really understanding that a nonprofit, it lends itself to how you basically get your revenue. And nonprofits are something where people go, I think that a lot of times we don't think about it, and teaching it is people go into it because they don't want to make a profit. And the thing is that, no, you have to make a profit. You have to care about money. Like you can't be a nonprofit and not care about money. It's about where it gets distributed. But the reality is that now a lot of companies, if you want to get money from corporations, you have to be a nonprofit because everyone wants to reduce their tax burden. So that was something that did not happen before. So you may have to think about two companies, right? With your one product. You might have to think about it in the perspective of growth and scale. It's specifically only because I'm in the restaurant space. I'll give that. People might have different opinions on it, but you cannot open a restaurant right now if you don't have a growth model. You will go bankrupt. The reason why most restaurants they fail, right? Within the first year or whatever, that statistic is. Because you think of fail within the first year, why do people keep opening up restaurants, right? You just keep opening them. It's because you don't understand like your cost structure and revenue. But the reality is that if you're only doing 3% revenue, 3% profit margin with your business, that means that you need to have other streams. You need to either have more locations, because the people that really make money are the ones that have more locations or more concepts. So do you grow it from I have a restaurant and then I might have a sauce product, or it's what the farmers are doing. So I have this farm that I've had in my family for generations, or I might've just bought one. And now I'm making only so much from what's coming from my land. But wow, can we take this and package it and sell milk and cheese? Can we sell t-shirts? Can we have people that stay over? Can we have events? So that's your growth. And then scale is, do I have multiple businesses, right? I understand everybody wants that one great restaurant that's going to change how we approach this restaurant. But then if it's not scalable, you're not going to, you need to have seven of them. So you have to come out the gate with it. And so that's my advice. My advice is to know every element about you should know how to out-talk me on a cake. And every element to it, how it affects the environment, so what are you doing with your packaging, all the way to the other side, which is your business structure, who's on your team, those are the two elements of entrepreneurship. And I am adamant about that avenue when it comes down to African Americans and businesses. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. What an excellent answer. And you have brought up a theme that has come up in quite a few conversations on this podcast, is doing your research, learning as much as you can, learning about the business part, learning about the technical part, learning the aesthetics, thinking about diversifying your streams of income. And it really supports the thought that people need to be a generalist in some ways, and not just a specialist. When I graduated from college, and also even my PhD program, which has been a while now, but I was told, you need to specialize, you need to specialize. And I think that we have some generations of individuals that are in the business world now, or entrepreneurs, and they're thinking, I was taught to specialize. But what I've heard from you and some of our other guests is that if you just specialize and you focus on just baking my cakes and baking them really well, you're probably not going to be able to do all the things that you need to do.
And you have to be honest with yourself. If you don't know then the other area, then you're going to have to trust somebody on your team that does. And you have to listen to them. And in all these platforms that I sit on, I have one platform that the staff said to me, they said, we would like to target these businesses and these particular restaurants in DC. And I said, I looked at the list and I said, oh. And I said, you probably sent them emails, right? These restaurant owners. Yes, and we just can't get in touch with them. We want to give them a free membership. And I'm like, oh no, you got to leave your desk and go into their restaurants. There's not a social media person that's checking, whatever. Like you have to, with certain, especially cultures, you have to engage with the owner. You have to engage with the culture. And I don't think they've done it. It's like, they don't believe. I said, tell the boss, he's going to have to give you some reimbursement dollars to go in and drive over and pay for parking. But that's how you're going to have to do that, because just even within cultures, you got to have a level of cultural context and cultural competence that just because you are representing this organization, that they're not going to stop just for you. They have to engage with you. Yeah, I think that's part of one of the things we talked about, where it's like innovation and what is it? It's sometimes you just have to, you have to do things a little bit differently. It's not that nobody cares. It's that you have to just approach it in a different perspective.
And you circled right back to the people. Learning about the people, understanding their culture, and then going and talking to the people.
Yep.
Yeah, we need people. So, you know, we've talked about this a bit, but some of the future of hospitality education, what do you envision? How do institutions need to prepare the next generation of leaders in hospitality?
Yeah, I think that the general big areas, of course, is how do we, the analytics, right? How do we take all this data and information and AI that we have and be able to make it work? And work in a meaningful, impactful way. How do we take this technology and apply it to solve problems? But I think probably maybe my thing, especially with what I'm on right now, I've been on it for over 10 years now, and that's making sure that students have the opportunity to go and travel globally, the global education. And I'm happy to be in a space where we've launched our first faculty led. I've been doing faculty led study abroads for 10 years. And when a faculty member approached me about a faculty led study abroad and why it was relevant for guest service relations class that he was teaching, I'm like, let's do it. And it was about really being able to educate, and fortunately having a dean and administration that trusted my decision making. And it was, there was more justification to go to Africa than any country, let alone a continent, and to be able to deliver students to go to Zambia. And we have neglected the continent of Africa in hospitality education. And I'm going on the record by saying that. Our fear, our elements, and to hear the students' presentation and their learning between the classroom, connecting the classroom and to their experience, and to all of the biases and negative information that was given, for them to come back and say, not only is it not true, there's thriving, there's, you only hear negative, was adamant. And so I think that the global competence is important, but I think that exposing our students to the rest of the world is going to be very, very, I think it's very impactful, because even when I did not go with them on the trip, my role was to give the professor the resources needed to make it happen. But everyone's asking, what can we do to attract more tourism? Minister of Tourism I met in Sierra Leone, and I said, you build out the infrastructure, but you have the advantage of having these 53 countries and young people in Africa, and young people are ready. They want to go. If this is a young person's thing, if I put it together a trip to Zambia, for, I don't know, grown people. I don't know. I don't know how it would have come off, but young people, they're ready, they're willing, they want to see. There's so many young Africans that are like, that have grown up in certain parts of Africa. This is not Africa. I want to go to West Africa. I want to see what I want to go to Ghana. I want to go to Gambia. I want to go to Sierra Leone. I want to see, go to a landlocked country and see one of the seven wonders, one of the multiple wonders of the world, waterfalls and things like that, and the people. And so I know I'm going way into a lot deeper into the answer, but the reality is hospitality education has to be inclusive of both a variety of ages of students that I've mentioned before, as well as opening up our education lens to the continent of Africa.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree with that for hospitality and many other disciplines, because you are right. But I saw on social media that you had that new program. So kudos for supporting your faculty and students with that initiative. Thinking about travel, you have a really exciting project coming up, a book project. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the hardest thing about writing a book is the writing part. But yeah, the Black Travel Movement, which I signed on to with Columbia University Press, really is it starts off as basically an ability to be able to let senior leaders, executives, know and understand both the economic, social, and cultural value of the Black and African American dollar in group events as it relates to travel. So the book is not about individual travel experiences. It's about understanding, especially in a U.S. context, the importance of why our historically Black colleges, why the Black church, and why our Black professional organizations are still the key to booking the larger, even larger events and more business. And there's a history behind that, and it still exists today. Regardless of whatever technology, media, whatever says, those institutions are very important, because it's those individuals that are in those institutions that are also members of the American Marketing Association, America Physicians Association, or whatever, that will look towards, one, travel in where we select to have our conferences and conventions, and also how they will select where their churches will go and their group events will go. So it's written on that basis. It's for understanding the cultural and economic nuances. What inspired me to write the book had to do with a series of events, once again, over a period of time that I observed. I was originally I was on a local organizing committee for the CIAA basketball tournament when I lived in Charlotte at Johnson & Wales. So this is between 2003-2005. Right. So the city of Charlotte at the time was looking for looking for revenue generators. Make a long story short. And so they attracted the CIAA. The CIAA is a very interesting time frame. It's the end of February going into the beginning of March. And it was just a great time in Charlotte. It's great weather. And they're like, let's go ahead and attract it. So the event started off when we were, after our first year of hosting it, we realized that a lot of the businesses said, we opened up early for the travelers, and we did not get the business. And so we realized as a LOC, we had to add a cultural nuance. CIAA is not just a basketball tournament where people go to the basketball. It's a family reunion. It's alumni weekend. It's sororities and fraternities. It's corporations that host suites and things such as that. So we had to show them that you have to be opened later. It's more of a later type of thing, because in the daytime, everybody's going to be at the event, at the basketball tournament, not really watching the tournament, but they're engaging with everybody else. That's how our homecoming bar, you know, it's the CIAA basketball tournament. So once they got that, it only took a year. Once they got that, next year, I think it was reported we had $35 million in economic impact in 5 days at the end of February. By the time that event matured to 2015, it was almost $60 million in economic revenue. It became a stop on really this kind of cultural events calendar. And in 2015, so I'm like, this is great. This is a great economic story, right? But in 2015, there was an article that came out about something called the Black Tax, where a hotel was charging, was adding on a CIAA tax to people's bills. And so basically it was this kind of overcharge. The conversation was this overcharging. A lot of businesses would not be, they chose to not be open during that time, a lot of businesses. And so it was what happened between the cultural conversation and nuance in 2003, 2004 to 2015 of this happening. Also in 20, so I'm getting this, I'm looking at this story while I'm at in Boston, and I'm going, what is going on? 2015, a study was done between MIT and University of Washington, where most people don't remember that when Uber first came out and these ride sharing companies, you didn't know how much you were paying. And so you just got whatever it was. These particular studies, and everybody can research this. There was a study that came out that showed that in Boston, African-Americans were charged more. And in Seattle, women were charged more. And then also in 2015, there was the conversation of the Black Bikers Weekend that came back up about how African-American bikers in South Carolina were restricted and overcharged differently than the Harley Weekend, which was part of, they both are over holiday weekends, but there was this overcharging. And so at this time in 2015, 2016, are these individual cases, or if taken together as an aggregate, is there some disconnect, something going on that's deeper than economics? It's not about money anymore when it comes down to African-Americans traveling in groups. And so that's the basis of the book, to be able to hopefully help leaders within communities, as well as leaders within our hospitality organizations, to articulate properly as to not either pushing back and denying African Americans in group spaces to book, or to overcharge them. And literally, I've had sales managers that said, I will go anonymously to discuss this because it still happens. Is this overcharging something that just needs to be addressed and developed much more? And so that's where the book is right now.
Exciting, exciting. And thank you for doing that work and bringing this to light. Do you have a publication date so we can, you know?
And I'll say stay tuned, because the editor, okay. Editors are kind of like, I'll say stay tuned. I have a lot of interviews. It's about pulling it all together to write it. So I'll say stay tuned, but it will be out. Give me my stuff for next year.
You have a lot that you're doing. That is absolutely understandable. And the book project is a big project.
It's a big project. Yeah. And there's a whole learning element to that too. So yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to have you back on to discuss the book when it's launched. Would love.
Absolutely. That's my motivation.
Our last question that we ask every guest is, how do you define innovation?
I see innovation as the ability to identify a gap and put and solve that gap in whatever way you deemed is missing. So innovation for me is, if you see a gap in knowledge, teach and how to close that gap. If you see a gap in inequality or an inequity, how can your product or idea or platform or whatever it is, even if you're just at work, being able to help address but also solve that, and that ability to just be able to do that, because there's enough challenge that comes with that. Innovation doesn't have to be redesigning the wheel, rehashing the wheel, or organizing, they come up with a new wheel. It's really about taking something that is not addressed and really being able to do that. Going back to the same Uber example, people have been sharing their cars for ever and ever and ever. And now when there's a platform for people to be able to get in a car with a stranger, we were told not to get in a car with strangers. Now we pay them. We get in a car with them. We pay them. And we have control of it on our phones. Like, who does that? But it wasn't a new idea. It was just the platform that someone said, nope, people have been renting their houses out forever. They've been forever. People, it's just the factor of having people, more people in the marketplace, and having this platform that now allows people to rent part of their house out, or their house as a whole. It's not a new idea. It's just that ability to bring something to the market that people desire, or it solves a problem. I know. And so that's what I think innovation is.
What an excellent answer, with some really wonderful examples that you included that people can really relate to and understand. Thank you. That was, and And thank you for this whole conversation. It has just been insightful, and your journey and contributions to the hospitality industry are really inspiring. And I'm personally grateful for our disciplines and for our students, that the impact that you're making in the area of hospitality, education, entrepreneurship, and innovation. So thank you for being here. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
For our listeners, please continue to follow Dr. Tucker Oluwole's work at UMES and the DMV Black Restaurant Week. To get in touch with her, she's on LinkedIn. I think you're on Instagram too, right?
Yes, etucker0818.
Okay. And then we'll also make sure that at the end of the podcast that we have ways to contact her. But we look forward to her upcoming book, The Black Travel Movement, and just to see what her leadership within academia and the communities that she serves continues to grow, both within the United States and globally. Thank you for being here. And also to our audience, remember to subscribe to our podcast to hear more interviews from thought leaders and innovators. And if you find this episode interesting, please leave some comments or share it with others. And with that, I will wrap up this interview. I am Dr. Yolanda Sanders. So please keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.